If you will, turn with me to Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews 11. Pick up the reading, verse 32. And what shall I say? What more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak, Samson and Jephthah, also of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, became valiant in battle, turned to flight the armies of the aliens, and women received their dead raised to life again. So we've been looking at Hebrews chapter 11. And remember, Hebrews 11 is dealing with the issue of faith. And as the writer of Hebrews said earlier in chapter 10, the just shall live by faith. And so we have to ask this question. We believe in the doctrine of justification by faith alone, but we also believe that the just shall live by their faith. So when the writer of Hebrews, who is writing to a persecuted group of Christians, Jewish Christians, who are threatening to apostatize and go back to Judaism because of all the persecutions that they were experiencing, the writer of Hebrews is telling them that you must live by your faith, just like all those who came before you. So the idea here is there's this abstract statement being made. The just shall live by faith. Well, to what extent? How far should you live? How far should you carry your faith? Well, then the author gives us chapter 11, and he gives you example after example from the Old Testament, those who live by their faith. Well, we have made it to verse 33, who through faith, and we've looked at these phrases, each one of them individually, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of the lions, and then this morning in verse 34, I want to deal with this one, quenched the fire, the violence of fire. Now, as you look at this, Hebrews 11, this whole chapter is not given to us as to, you know, reminisce about when God used to work. You know, it's not given to us to say, you know, boy, I bet it was kind of neat living in the days of all those patriarchs when God was doing great, wonderful things. This chapter was not given for us to reminisce about the good old days. This chapter is given to us, encouraging us into action. And as we were talking about earlier in our time of prayer, when the church stops being salt, the culture will decay. What you see in culture going on, what you just shake your head in disbelief and disgust at, we need to thank the church for that one. Because the church stopped being salt a long time ago. We abandoned all these areas over to the unbelievers to run and manage. And now we're seeing the consequences of all this decay. The church needs to go back and start being salt and light back into the community. And so we have a story this morning we're going to go through, right? We have a story, this idea, by faith they quenched the violence of fire. And we all know that, you know, he could be, you know, talking about how he saved Lot and them from, you know, the fires that poured down on Sodom and Gomorrah. We could go look at that story, right? But I think we understand he's probably referring to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So the author of Hebrews is showing the efficacy of faith as faith rests upon the power of God in the face of great danger. And so we remember their story, right? They were facing certain death. The point the author of Hebrews is trying to make is that those three Hebrews, they resolved to perform their duty, no matter what it cost them. They faithfully served Jehovah, and they were content to leave the consequences of their lives up to Him. They understood something that we forget. We are here for His pleasure. And so they were fully persuaded of His power to do whatever He pleases, to do whatever generated the most glory for Himself. And in that day, it gained God more glory to save these men. And there's a reason why. We're going to go back and look at this when we look at Daniel 3 in just a moment. There's a reason why. Pink made this comment. Such an exercise of faith appears very, very marvelous to us. Ah, let it be fully borne in mind that Daniel and his fellows trusted God in times of peace and prosperity as well as in seasons of peril and adversity. If we live by faith, notice that, if we live by faith, it will not be difficult to die by faith. Those that struggle with the concept of dying by faith are struggling to live by faith. And so this is the takeaway we get from Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I think this story is important for us to understand because it teaches us how to respond when difficulties and challenges come. And I realize that some churches, it's a neat children's story. But there are some eternal principles being taught within Daniel 3 that we as adults need to take away. We as the people of God need to understand. And here's the thing, it's easy to trust God when the kingdom of God seems to be advancing, right? When good things seem to be happening with respect to the kingdom of God, then we can all collectively think, boy, God is on the throne. Right? That's how we typically think. But what about when the times are not going so good? Does that mean God's no longer on the throne? Right? That's how many in the church react. I read earlier this week on one of the social media outlets, and this guy was in a mocking way say, imagine telling the Afghanistan Christians Jesus is on the throne. Real condescending and mocking, right? But someone wisely responded, imagine telling them he's not. Right? The story we're about to look at, though, in Daniel 3 is just a reminder to us all that God is always ruling, even when things are not going the way we want them to. Okay? And this is what I think many of the Israelites in the days of Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were thinking while they're there in exile. And remember, it was God who put them in exile. When they were sitting under the Babylonian kings, under their banners, under their gods, when their armies defeated the children of Israel, I'm sure many of them were thinking, God cannot be on the throne. But God sent his prophets to tell them, this is exactly a demonstration that God is on the throne because he's punishing you for your disobedience and your wickedness. When you read Daniel 2, for example, you remember in Daniel 2, this is where Nebuchadnezzar had his dream and Daniel interprets the dream for him. In Daniel chapter 2, we see that God controls history because he knows it, because he ordains it, right? Nebuchadnezzar is in charge only because God placed him there. And in God's due time, God is going to remove Nebuchadnezzar and raise up another kingdom for his own purpose. And in that dream, we see that God is going to raise up these kingdoms until a fourth kingdom comes. And this would be the kingdom set up by the Messiah, and that kingdom would be forever. The great prophecy in chapter 2 of Daniel was given so that every Jew would know the Messiah is coming. When you see these kingdoms rise and fall, all these mighty kingdoms, and we think of the kingdoms of the Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks, and the Romans, all were there captured in the vision. And then he says there's another kingdom. It starts off as a small rock, not made with hands, that grows into a mountain that covers the earth. When that kingdom comes, when you see these false kingdoms coming, rising and falling, know the Messiah is coming. And he's going to establish his kingdom. And so all kings need to come to a realization at the end of Daniel chapter 2 that God is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. So turn over to Daniel 3. Daniel 3. Let's look at all this. And if Daniel 2 teaches us that, for example, that God is sovereign over the kingdoms, then Daniel 3 will teach us that God is sovereign even over the words of the king. I want to show you something there quickly. In Daniel 3, the beginning of Daniel 3 starts off with this decree, but I want to show you something at the end because this is where all things are headed, right? At the end of Daniel 3, notice this in verse 28 at the very end. He said, Nebuchadnezzar spoke saying, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him, and they have frustrated the king's word. That's important because the chapter starts off with the king's word. The king gives a decree for everyone to bow down and worship these idols, right? But the king's word is frustrated and yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own god. Therefore, I make a new decree, right? God's law always trumps man's law. And God will ultimately cause all of man's laws to be changed. So I want you to remember that. He decreed, you know, the king Nebuchadnezzar decreed that all must obey his word. Death was given to those who did not obey his word. He believed that there was no higher law than the words of his mouth. He did not think that he was accountable to anyone. And this chapter teaches us that he was exactly wrong, absolutely wrong. And he confesses that his word has been nullified by God. The tension in this chapter is between God's command and the command of the king. There's the tension, right? The law of God clearly teaches us that we can only worship Jehovah. It's in the first commandment, right? We do not have the authority to worship any other gods, but Nebuchadnezzar put his law in opposition to the clear command of God's law. This is the tension of chapter 3, and this is the tension that we are starting to live in today. So I think this chapter is very relevant. So what do we do when the laws of men conflict with the laws of God? Well, this chapter teaches us that we must always submit to the higher law of God. We will see in this chapter that our obedience to God is a requirement and that God works through history to glorify himself through the obedience of his people. And through the expansion of his kingdom, he will change the law of man as he changes the hearts of man. And we saw this example, you know, for example, in the Roman Empire. They brutally persecuted Christians in the first, second, third century. But in his time, that changed. It took centuries. It took many Christians who had to pay with their life to change the view of that culture, of that kingdom. And so this chapter teaches me that we should always live as though God is sovereign over all of man's laws. God raises up kingdoms and then he takes them down at his pleasure. Now before we read chapter 3 of Daniel, I want to point out one thing. Go back to chapter 2 at the very end. I just want you to see a statement. In Daniel 2:46, we read this. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face. Now this is after Daniel has interpreted the dream. Remember, the requirement that the king gave him is, I'm not going to tell you the dream. You've got to tell me the dream that I had and then give its interpretation. Daniel did all of this, right? So at this point in verse 46, then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel, and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. The king answered Daniel and said, "Truly, your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and the revealer of secrets, since you could reveal the secret." Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and the chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. Also, Daniel petitioned the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel sat in the gate of the king. All right. He openly acknowledges here at the end of chapter 2 that Jehovah is the God of gods. But then when you come to chapter 3, he goes and sets up an idol and forces everyone to worship this idol. In other words, if you confess that Jehovah is the God of gods, because the thing here that I see is many Christians really struggle with this idea. This seems contradictory. How could he say this in chapter 2 and then immediately in chapter 3, which I assume there's a decent time period between these two chapters, but how could he go from what he said in chapter 2 to raising up and erecting idols in chapter 3? In other words, if you confess that Jehovah is the God of gods, then why would you set up an idol and worship another god? Why would you do that? But if you step back and think about this for a minute, this is not really abnormal. You see this go on all the time with our leaders. Many of our leaders do this. Biden claims to be a Catholic. They profess the name of God, right? But then he acknowledges all these false gods, and then he behaves as though he's an unbeliever, even for a Catholic standard. Think about Trump. Trump claimed to be a Christian. Obama even claimed to be a Christian at times when it suited him. George Bush, the younger one, claimed to be a Christian. And that's how he got the religious right back in the early 2000s. He ran off that petition. He quote Bible verses, sing hymns halfway, and misapply them. Think about Clinton. Even Clinton went to church, if you can believe it. The first George Bush did. Reagan did it. All these men did the very same thing that Nebuchadnezzar is doing here. They all say they worship the true God, but then turn around and say we must worship the state. They turn around and then acknowledge that Muslims and every other false religion is just as legitimate as Christianity. Do you remember after 9/11, the first George Bush, he claimed to be a strong Christian, right? He participates in a national day of prayer where the whole rainbow of false gods were acknowledged and prayed to on that day, if you remember it. And so what we see here with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, right? You know, Nebuchadnezzar's not unusual here. He's doing what every other ruler we've seen in our day and age that we've lived through. They've all acknowledged Jesus. But then they pray and acknowledge all these other false gods. Well, that's exactly what Nebuchadnezzar's doing. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they had enough discernment to see through all this. And what we need to ask ourselves is how many Christians today would bow down to the idol the state erects? If I give you a stimulus check, would you bow down and worship this idol? I bet many in the church probably would. Think about it this way. Here, there's a lot of ways we could press this issue in corners. I don't want to spend a lot of time diverging into it, but at least think about what the state has been doing and what they've been telling us as Christians, how we've been treating homosexuals. Right? You've been treating these homosexuals wrong all this time, calling them sinners. And so for you, you must bow down and acknowledge their marriage as a true marriage. And many in the church have done exactly that. Well, they love each other. They acknowledge and give credit that these men that marry men and these women that marry women, they legitimize their marriage, but God's Word doesn't. Right? Most denominations have bowed their knee to the state and said, okay, whatever you say. We have a tension between God's law and man's law at this point, don't we? The church has forgotten what godly disobedience, civil disobedience, looks like. But thank God that he did preserve this story for us so that we can learn. We need to be a people who do not bow down so quickly unless it is to serve and worship Jehovah and him alone. We need to follow in their footsteps and exhibit true saving faith. Another thing we need to point out before we get into this story. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are not being punished because they worship God. Why are they being punished? They're being punished because they refuse to bow their knee to the state and worship the God of the state. Think about Japan before World War II. You could go into a Christian church as long as you bow down in the Shinto temple there in the vestibule. You know, as long as you bow down, you could go worship whatever God after you bow down, right? In China today, you have a state church. As long as you acknowledge that the state gets to decide what is a church, this means you can't go and submit to the Bible. As long as you acknowledge that the ultimate authority is the Chinese government, you can worship whatever you want, right? You see the very same thing, for example, in early church history, right? Rome didn't persecute and burn Christians because they were worshiping Jesus. They burned and persecuted Christians because they wouldn't worship Caesar. You understand the difference? Most of the reformers who were persecuted and burned at the stake were not burned at the stake because they were worshiping Jesus. It's because they refused to worship the idols and the relics of the Catholic Church and the idols that they set up. These men and women, most of the time, are not being killed because they worship Jesus. They are being killed and persecuted because they would not commit idolatry. They were put to death. Most of the Christians throughout history were persecuted and murdered because they won't worship the idols of whatever age they lived in. And we have stories, even from our own families, don't we? You have strife and difficulties and conflict with your own family and your relatives, not because you worship the true Jesus. The conflict is usually over because you won't acknowledge the idol of the Jesus they've erected. The Jesus they've erected tolerates their sin, right? The Jesus they have erected in their mind and bow down and worship to allows them to sin at will, and they say there are no consequences to their sin. And so they give you a hard time because you're calling out, well, that's not the true Jesus. The fact that you refuse to worship an idol that they've created infuriates them. But each of us needs to resolve. We're not going to bow down. We're not going to serve any idol, whether it's erected by the state or our family members, our friends, whoever. All right. That's what's happening here. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are not being persecuted because they're worshiping Jehovah. They just won't worship the idol of the state. So let's look at chapter 3. Look at verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura and the province of Babylon. So the king made an image of gold. And this is stated multiple times throughout this chapter. This is the act of the king. It is his action as king. He is acting contrary to God's law. It is an image of gold. Now, some speculate, you know, about what the image was. Was it an image of the king himself, or was it the image of a false god? It's not really stated here, and I don't really think it matters, because the ancient Babylonians, at least to the ancient Babylonians, the king was the incarnation of their god or a representative of their god. The state was seen as divine. The state was the source of life and order. Prosperity came through the blessing of the state. So just remember, when a culture rejects the true God, its true creator, they must put divinity in some other place. And most of the time, in both ancient and modern history, man puts that divinity in the state. The state is seen as the source of power. And this is how, you know, most unsaved people understand where the divinity, who they worship, who they're going to serve. Because they understand the power of force and violence. And so if there's going to be order in an ungodly society, then it must be imposed by the power of the state. Well, if I was pressed on which one it was, I would say the image was an image of false gods. For example, they worshiped Baal. It seems from the context that these three godly saints refused to bow down and worship the false gods of the king. So there must, you know... That's kind of my take on it, is just kind of reading between the lines. It was a direction of some kind of idol of one of their false gods, probably Baal. But in any event, that's what they were being told. And this must have been an impressive looking idol, because, you know, if you look at this and start looking at these numbers, it's about 90 feet tall, about 9 feet wide. That's a huge image, right? Now look at verse 2. And the king Nebuchadnezzar sent word, gathering together all these authorities, you know, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So the satraps and the administrators and the governors, the counselors and the treasurers and the judges, the magistrates and all the officials of the provinces gathered together for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So notice here, all the leading officials, all the nations that had been conquered by the Babylonians, all these different ones that rule for Nebuchadnezzar, they were called to the king's dedication of this image. It's likely that the king was trying to consolidate his kingdom, increase his power at this, and increase his power at this ceremony. He wanted all the people to recognize the supremacy of his rule. And the conventional wisdom of the day was that Babylon was successful because their gods were more powerful than the nations they overcame. And so when they came, they were paying homage to the sovereignty of Babylon and to Nebuchadnezzar as God's representative, as their false god's representative. Now notice what the king is doing. He's claiming that he has authority and power to compel all men to worship his god. Furthermore, he's daring anyone to resist his law, isn't he? Now it appears that there were some who might try to resist worshiping his false god, so he threatens with the death penalty, right? The death penalty is given to those who do not recognize his absolute sovereignty. And this death would be by fire. This is one of the favorite ways that the Babylonians would kill people. You can just visualize this scene. You got all these musicians there, right? You have this huge ceremony, and somewhere to the right or to the left, but within eyesight, there's this huge furnace with the fire stoked, ready to burn anyone who's not willing to bow down and worship this image. So we understand this penalty. And in fact, it's a penalty that makes something a law, right? You cannot have a law without a sanction. If you don't have sanctions, otherwise it's just a suggestion. It's just good advice. And this is important to note because the law is going to be changed by the end of the chapter. Now look at verse 4. Then a herald cried out, "To you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, the lyre, the psaltery, the symphony, with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up, and whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of the burning fiery furnace." So at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the horn, flute, the harp, the lyre, and the symphony, with all kinds of music, all people, all nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the king image, the gold image which the king Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Now notice the command to worship this false god. The command is given, once again, to recognize the supremacy of the Babylonian gods. To celebrate this, you know, impressive ceremony, they bring all these arrays of instruments from across the land. So this kind of adds to the grandeur of the occasion, right? And so the command is simple. Once the music plays, you just fall down and you worship. The word worship here means to give homage by prostrating yourself to the ground. And keep in mind, to pay homage means to pay homage in this public event, you're acknowledging the sovereignty and the supremacy of King Nebuchadnezzar. In other words, they were publicly paying allegiance to the gods of the Babylonians and their representative Nebuchadnezzar by prostrating themselves before them. You know, you think of what a slave would do to a master or to a lord. Now, this word worship shows up several times, and therein lies the tension. They are commanded to worship this image, but God's law strictly forbids to worship anything but Jehovah. And so there's another word that is brought up in the context, and it's this word serve. These men down in verse 12 were served. They were charged that they don't serve. They don't not only don't worship, but they don't serve. This word serve means to give reverence to, literally means to work hard at worship. Hold your place here and go over to Isaiah 44. We'll come right back, but just look at Isaiah 44. Isaiah 44 is dealing with this issue of worshiping idols. Isaiah 44, look at verse 15. "Then it shall be for a man to burn, for he will take some of it and warm himself," talking about the wood. And so, yes, he kindles it, bakes bread. Indeed, he makes a god and worships it. He makes it a carved image and falls down to it. There's our word. "He burns half of it in the fire, and with his half he eats the meat. He roasts the roast and is satisfied." He even warms himself and says, "Ah, I'm warm. I've seen the fire." And the rest of it he makes into a god. He carved the image, and here it is. He falls down before it and worships it, prays to it, and says, "Deliver me, for you are my God." Verse 18, they do not know nor understand, for he has shut their eyes so that they cannot see, and their hearts so that they cannot understand. And no one considers in his heart, nor is there knowledge nor understanding to say, I have burned half of it in the fire. Yes, I have also baked bread on its coals. I have roasted meat and eaten it, and I shall make the rest of it an abomination. Shall I fall down before a block of wood? Now, notice here, this word typically is used of serving an idol. This word fall down, it's the very same word we're seeing over here in Daniel, verse 3 and 12, or chapter 3 and verse 12. But to fall down to worship a false god is idolatry. This is a clear violation of the first commandment. The king, you know, is saying, thou shalt fall down and worship this idol, right? The king is saying this. But God's law is saying, thou shalt not. Now, what do you do? What do you do? Okay. Turn back to Daniel chapter 3. Look at verse 7. So at that time, when all the people heard the sound, all the people, all these people that are there, all these people heard the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, the lyre, and the symphony with all kinds of music. All the people, the nations, and language, they all do this. They all fall down. They all worship the golden image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Everyone obeys. Everyone submits. That sound familiar? Starting to sound a little familiar, doesn't it? And when they do this, they're saying, O king, your law is supreme, and you have the right to call us to bow down and worship this false god. You have the right to call us to sin. Right? That's what they're saying. They're acknowledging that there is no higher law than you. And everything, you know, you think about the king, he set this up. He's looking for a good turnout, a good day. He wants everyone to comply. And everything seems to be going good. And then three godly troublemakers show up. That's how you're going to be seen. When everyone else is bowing down, you're going to be seen as the troublemaker when you don't bow down. Are you ready for that? Right? This is the first step where most Christians today fall and fail. Nobody even has to get the furnace started up. The furnace is sitting over there rusting today in this country. It's rusting because there's no need to put coals and waste energy firing it up because most people won't get through this first step. Oh, everybody else is bowing down worshiping this idol. I guess I better do it as well. But three godly troublemakers show up and they ruin the party. Have you ever been called a troublemaker when you show up to a family event? God's name is being dishonored. Sinful things are being discussed, laughed about, joked about, sin being bragged about, and then you show up. Oh my goodness, here they are. You want to be a godly troublemaker? Or do you want to be bowing down, following, and worshiping idols? Because when people, your family members, who claim to worship and serve Christ, at the same time laugh and joke about sin, they're these people. They're verse 7. They're bowing down to an idol. They've already erected an idol. They're worshiping their idol, right? Well, God sends troublemakers to bring about revival. God sends troublemakers to bring about reformation. You a troublemaker? Or do you just follow along, go along, get along? Look at verse 8. Therefore at the time certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to the king Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, the lyre, and the psaltery, and the symphony, with all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the gold image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve, here's that word, serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up. Well, here we see the charge against these men, right? The word that is used for accused is a word for biting. It had this idea of malicious hatred, right? There's a sense of jealousy here that these men had against these young Jewish men. These young Jewish men had found favor. They had higher authoritative positions than many of the Babylonians did. And so they're jealous. And here's their opportunity to come after them and to get rid of them. And so with malice and hatred, they come to accuse these young men. Look at verse 10. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, the lyre, the psaltery, the symphony, of all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the gold image. And he's reminding them, and whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. They believe in his authority. And they're going to use this to their advantage. Thou, O king, right? You have made this law. and those who do not fall down to worship shall die. Now notice how they accuse these godly troublemakers. Verse 12. There are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, they've not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up. They've not regarded you, O king. They do not give you proper recognition. They do not recognize your glory. They do not respect your authority by not recognizing your word is law. And so this enrages the king. And so what does the king do? So we see the response of these godly troublemakers. And so now Nebuchadnezzar is going to call in these troublemakers and start to interrogate them. Look at verse 13. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up?" And he's outraged. Someone has questioned, not only questioned his word, but defied his command, his law. That's his mindset. He does not recognize a higher law, does he? But he's a gracious king. Right? He's a gracious king because he's going to give them one more chance to sin against their God. And that's what unbelievers will do. Before they really tear into you and rip your head off, they'll give you one more chance to acknowledge their idol. And so this is what he does in verse 15. Look, now if you're ready, at the time you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, the lyre, the psaltery, and the symphony with all kinds of music, you fall down and worship the image which I have made good. But if you do not worship, you will be cast immediately into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Notice the ultimatum here. You can worship my gods, or in the same hour you'll be thrown into the fire. Right? I'm giving you one more chance to recognize my sovereignty here. Don't blow it. Don't make me throw you into the fire. And notice the challenge in the last clause. Who is the God that will deliver you out of my hands? Notice the arrogance here. This is the arrogance of fallen mankind to issue such a threat. And just understand, this is the very same arrogance that every fallen creature possesses when they refuse to submit to the will of God. And every time we choose to live this autonomous, this self-willed life, we are threatening God by saying, "What you gonna do?" Right? That's the arrogance of sin. What will you do? When we read this story, we need to look at these sinful traits that are so obvious in Nebuchadnezzar and make sure they're not found in us. What areas have you set up your own law above God's law and are threatening God? What are you going to do to me? Now, this sets up a great response, and this is where faith comes in, and this is what the writer of Hebrews wants us to pick up. Now, consider the scene. How would you respond? You have a huge crowd. Everybody's looking at you. Man, you're ruining the party. We can't even have a good dinner because you're messing everything up, right? You troublemakers. This is where faith comes in. What are you going to do? That's the scene. All these people are looking at you. Peer pressure. Can you handle it? But you got more than peer pressure. You've got this angry man trying to stand over you. And he has the authority to throw you into the furnace. And he says, "Now get out there, don't embarrass me, submit to my authority, bow down to my false gods, and worship them." Now what are you going to do? What would you do? Think about the Canadian pastor who was thrown into jail when he got out. He said, I'll see you in church on Sunday. The intimidation tactics of the state to try to stop you. What are you going to do? The state says you cannot worship. What are you going to do? Or you can worship in a way that's authorized by them. Then what are you going to do? All right. Look at verse 16. Look at this response. You need to memorize this. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." What they are saying is that they're not being arrogant and smug, right? When they say in verse 16, they're saying, "We have no need to answer you in this matter." What they're saying is, we've thought about this. We didn't just come up here with no idea what we're going to do. We understood the summons. We submit to you. and we're going to come to you here to you, but we've already made up our mind. We're not worshiping false gods. See, if you haven't thought through this, you're just going to look around and say, oh, well, let's just get on the ground and get to the food, right? That's what most Christians would do today because they haven't thought through this. They say, we know what we're doing, and the consequences of submitting to you far outweigh the consequences of refusing you. Remember the words of Jesus. Do not fear the one who can kill the body, but fear the one who can both kill body and soul. And their point here is that there is no need for an apology. There's no need for us to give a defense. We're not going to apologize for being troublemakers. We're not going to apologize for ruining your ceremony here. I'm not going to apologize to you because I am going to be true to my God, the true God. You ever have these unbelievers? You're ruining everything. These compromising Christians, they're trying to shame you. They want you to apologize. There's nothing to apologize for. If you dishonor God's name, my God, the true God, I'm not just going to sit back here and listen to it. I'm going to respond to it. And you're not going to make me capitulate to your compromising position. You're not going to make me capitulate to your idol. So there's no need for an apology. There's no need for a defense here. This is why you hear me say all the time, we should never apologize to the unbeliever for our commitment to our God. You just shouldn't. But notice the response of these young men in verse 17 again. If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. Any of y'all know any young men who would speak like this? Visualize the scene. Everybody else is bowing down, worshiping the idol. The furnace is being stoked to burn you, to throw you in there. Are there any young men who would say, I'm going to trust my God on this one, but I can't. My knees, they just won't bend, right? I just won't do this. I refuse to do this. But notice here, we have cheapened faith to this mere intellectual knowledge of facts. The whole point of Hebrews chapter 11 is to teach us that true saving faith contains an element of trust and commitment. So notice carefully how they respond. They say, if. This is not an if of unbelief, but it's an if concerning God's will. They recognize the sovereignty of God's will in this circumstance, and they're saying, it may be that God does not desire to deliver us, and we're okay with that. They know their God has the power to spare them. He's able to save them, but they're content with God's will no matter the outcome. Why? They want their God to be glorified. And so for them, if it glorifies God to allow them to die, then they're willing to submit to his will. Remember the catechism question. How do we glorify God? Children, do you remember? Do you remember how to glorify God? By loving him and doing what he commands. Your greatest act of love to God is always do what he commands. Not worry about the outcome. The command of God is to worship him and him alone, even if someone is threatening you with a fiery furnace. A life of faith is only concerned with what God wants. And God did not want them to bow down to this image. God only wants us to worship and serve him alone. Now, is that how you think? Has your mind been transformed in this area? Is these principles firmly set down? I'm not going to violate the first commandment no matter what. And before you answer that question, consider, you have all these other dignitaries around. They're all bowing down. What would you do? These are questions we need to think of. Children, just consider. You got these young kids around you and they're saying, come and do this. But you know your mother and father say, I would not tolerate that. I would not approve of what they're about to do, right? What do you do then? You got someone pressuring you to disobey your father and mother. What do you do? Well, God's commands are very clear. You got to honor your father and mother first. No matter, even if you lose all your friends. You willing to do that? You see, people who don't go through the moral law of God and set these down as firm principles that I'm going to live by, they're going to capitulate, right? Everybody else is doing it. Everybody else is bowing down. Everybody else is worshiping the false god. I don't want to cause any waves. I don't want to ruin this man's, you know, dinner because he's pretty serious about the ceremony. He's got a fiery furnace over here for me to see. What would you do? These are questions we need to think through because this may become a reality, right? I mean, if we are there before this great king who has life and death power over us, then we would set the example. Would we? Would we set the example? By refusing to bow down because that's what God desires? Now remember, this king is angry. He's burning with anger. He's pointing to the furnace. What would you say? And notice that their words and their actions are not based upon the outcome. They did this as an act of obedience to God, and this is why the writer of Hebrews is pointing us back to these men. In other words, these men did not want to do anything that would dishonor His name. Now look at verse 18. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. Now this is interesting because they acknowledge Him as their king, right? He's the rightful authority. In God's providence, He has placed this man as king over them. He was their king. But what we see here is that there are limits to His authority. Even though you are king, we're not going to obey you in this matter because there's a higher law that we must submit to. Now, whenever rulers command what God forbids or forbid what God has commanded, then the course is clear. We must obey God, right? This is exactly what we see in Acts 5:29. When they told these men, do not preach Christ anymore, what did they say? Woe be it to us that we don't do what God commands, right? We're not going to listen to you. We're not going to submit to your authority in this area because you've just gone beyond your authority. So the response to those who forbid the preaching of Jesus Christ, that's how they responded. And the point here is that there's limits to government authority. The same is true with church authority. The church authority must not go beyond what God has ordained. The same is true of familial authority, your family authority. As a father, I do not have the authority to cause my wife or children to sin against their God. All right? You're probably going to see a lot in these coming up days if you haven't seen it already. Romans 13. But Romans 13 is being misapplied. You don't just always submit to the government, no matter what. Just like if I came in here today or the authority of this church came in here and said, do something that went against God's will, we don't have the authority. Even though Hebrews 13 says you should submit. Even though God's word says, wives, submit to your husband, doesn't mean you submit to sin. Right? What the idea is that each jurisdictional head has limits given to his authority. And we must stay, and as long as we stay within the confines of that authority, you should submit because it's for your own good. But when we go beyond that authority, then your response is to disobey us, not God, right? All right. I hope that's clear to you. I hope that makes sense. Because I'm seeing and watching a lot of arguments amongst Christians on social media outlets where there's a lot of confusion on what level of submission we should give. These godly troublemakers are giving us a great example of what we would call civil disobedience. Whenever there's a conflict between God's law and man's law, you must always submit to God's law. That's the principle. All right. So memorize these words, verse 17 and 18, the response of these men, because you may need them one day. You need to have those firmly planted in your heart because one day you may need to quote them. Look at verse 19. Here we see the deliverance of these godly troublemakers. Verse 19, then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the expression on his face changed toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And he spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. So now we have these young godly men. They gave a response that honored God, right? And when we do this, we expect the enemies of God to say, well, thank you. I'm glad you're honoring your God. And if you're expecting a hug from the enemies of God, you are going to be discouraged and you're going to be greatly disappointed. You're setting yourself up for these things, right? The enemy will not give up their ground easily. He's not going to give up his authority easily. God needs to make a show at this point. All right. When God's law comes into opposition with man's law, whether it's government or your neighbor, the unbeliever will fight for his law and be enraged when you bring God's law into the conversation. Right? We see this all the time down at the abortion clinic. You go out there, you plead with this young lady, this young man, don't kill your child. If you're expecting them to sit there and say, thank you, kind sir, you're going to be discouraged and disappointed. The first thing you're going to get is an obscene finger gesture. Then they're going to start cussing at you. Now let's think about that for a moment. Their law, man's law, says I can kill. It's my right, my body. I can kill this child. God's law says you can't. I hate the shedding of innocent blood. Now they're angry and screaming at you. They're enraged. They're mad. And I have to remind them, ma'am, sir, I'm not angry because I'm not here wanting to kill a child. Why are you so angry? They don't want to hear God's law on the matter. When you press the claims of God's law, when it comes into conflict with man's law, You're going to get this response. You need to be ready for it. And you need to act, but you don't need to react. You don't let them push your buttons. You don't cause them to cause you to sin by the way you react to them. Remember, we always represent the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And this is always interesting. Pay attention to how these young men react in the face of an enraged king who is threatening to throw them into the fire. So we see the rage of the king. The sentence of these young men has been set. You can even see it in the lines of his face. He commands the furnace to be heated up hotter than normal. This is the king's way of saying, I will show this God. I will heat the furnace up 7 times hotter. And even if he's a great God, he can't do anything about it. He can't save you. That's his idea. Look at verse 20. He commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. He calls for his most courageous, the strongest men in his army to bind these men. He put them into the fiery furnace. But little these men know. I want you to think about this, young people. Little these men realize that this would be their last day. And their last act was to throw faithful men of God into the fiery furnace. You know, I bet when they woke up, they thought this is going to be a great day of celebration. All we got to do is go hang out, listen to some good music, and eat some good food. It's going to be a great day of celebration. They didn't realize this is going to be the day that death would overcome them. And these men are a reminder to us that any day, any moment could be our last. And we need to be ready always for death to overtake us. These men were not ready as they threw God's servants into the furnace. Look at verse 21. Then these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments, and they were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's command was urgent, the furnace was exceedingly hot, and the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down bound into the midst of the fiery furnace, the burning fiery furnace. Notice how hot this firewood was. It was so hot that it was able to kill these mighty men. Text says they were mighty men, right? I assume they were mighty in battle. I assume with their strength, their training for battle, in their minds, I bet they thought they were invincible. But they were not able to withstand the fires of the king. Now, do you think that they were equipped to withstand the fires of the King of Kings? Because the moment they step into eternity, that's what they face. The picture here is very clear for us. God may choose to save you from the fires of men, but no one can save you from the fires of hell. This should put a great sense of urgency when it comes to sharing the gospel to those we say we love. But we know where they're headed. When they step into eternity, there's not going to be anyone there to save them. And so the point here is we need to choose carefully the master we wish to serve. You're going to go along and get along. You're going to follow all the masses, the pathway, the wide path that leads to destruction. Christ is very clear here. You can only serve one master. Those who serve him may lose their life in service to him, but boy, they gain everything. They gain Christ. Notice the deliverance of God. Verse 24. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, "Did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire?" And they answered and said to the king, O king, look, he answered, "I see four men loose walking in the furnace of the fire, and they are not hurt, and the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." Well, now think about the depravity of Nebuchadnezzar. He's so depraved that he had a seat where he could actually watch these men burn alive. He wanted to actually see the triumph over these men. But you know what? He doesn't get to witness a victory that day, did he? He does not get to see them annihilated or burned to ashes. God does not give him that privilege that day. He sees these three men walking around in the fire unharmed. Now there's someone else, something that's unexpected that happens. He sees a fourth, one who's like the Son of God. I don't think he's necessarily making some kind of Trinitarian statement here, but what he is saying is that there is a divine being in the fire, one who is from the race of the gods. But there's something about the countenance of this fourth that set him apart from all the others, right? The other three. So who is this fourth? It was either an angel of God or the angel, the pre-incarnate Christ. It's not clear to me what's being taught here. We don't know because the text doesn't tell us. The point of this text, though, is to show us the great deliverance of God for these troublemakers. And I want you to see what he says in verse 26. Then Nebuchadnezzar went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke, saying, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out, come here. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came from the midst of the fire, and the satraps and the administrators, the governors and the kings and the counselors gathered together. And they saw these men on whose these bodies the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, and their garments were not affected, and the smell of fire was not even on them. And so here we see an admission of complete defeat by the king, right? He refers to these three men as the servants of the Most High God. He bids the men, come out of there. And so they come out. They come forth from the fire. But don't forget the scene, right? All the leaders of all the nations that Babylon has secured or subdued, they're all there. All the leaders from around the empire, they would have witnessed this great event. Nebuchadnezzar wanted to display the might of his kingdom and his gods. But Jehovah had another plan for that day, didn't he? He wanted to display his power, his might on this day. And never forget this point. When the hour seems the most bleak, when the hour is the most dark, be ready for God to step in and intervene. When the arrogance of our government officials gets really, really bad, and it gets more and more obvious, the days grow darker, it seems more bleak, that nothing's going to save and turn around, that's when God will actually step in. God put these men in a place where it would be evident to all that it was the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego who preserved them. It was God who accomplished this great victory. And we should never forget this principle. We get so discouraged when things get tough or plans don't go our way. The plans don't go the way we want them. But that's a result of unbelief, not faith. True faith trusts that God will accomplish the impossible. And under the protection of Jehovah, the fire had no power over these men. And remember, the fire was the sanction of the king's law. It was the punishment. But his law had no power. The fire did not consume them. It didn't even change their garments. It didn't even burn their hair. It didn't even leave a smell on them. So notice how the king responds. Verse 28, Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants, who trusted in him. And they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own. Therefore I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut into pieces, and their houses shall be made as an ash heap, because there is no other god who could deliver like this. And then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. The king is overwhelmed, right? He's overwhelmed by what he witnessed. Now notice this phrase, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Instead of giving reverence and honor to his false gods, right? He is now giving reverence and honor to the great God, the only God, the true God. The God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And notice, this is a result of these men trusting in their God. They refused to dishonor their God by compromising and worshiping this false God. This would have meant a lot to the people who were being persecuted that the writer of Hebrews is writing to, right? They're being persecuted. They're being threatened with all kinds of persecution. And the writer of Hebrews is saying, don't forget the example of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Trust God. Submit to Him. Don't abandon Christ and turn to these false religious worship of these Pharisees. Now from this great praise, we see here that the king's word is changed. Look at verse 28 again. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his saints, or his servants who trusted in him. And they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship except their own God. The word change here means to alter, but it has this idea of nullifying what he decreed earlier. Many times when this word it was used with a law in mind. You see this, write this one down when you have time to go look at it, Ezra 6:11. But remember over in Ezra, Darius gave a decree, and anyone who altered that decree would pay with their life. But that's our word. This word refers to those who stand by to nullify, nor give regard to a law of the king. And in Ezra 6:11, the king said, you're going to die. So the point of this word is that my law has been changed. My law has been nullified by the great God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. In Daniel 2, you saw that God is sovereign over history, but here in chapter 3, God wants us to know that He's sovereign even over the law of the king, even when it's a wicked law. God can change, God can nullify, God can empty the law of earthly kings whenever He desires. Notice they yielded their bodies, What did they yield their bodies to? They yielded their bodies to the fire and death if necessary. They didn't care. Their bodies were to glorify God. They offered themselves up to the glory of their God, their Creator. They refused to serve or worship just any God. They only gave themselves to the worship of Jehovah. Their obedience has changed the word of the king. Here's the point. If we want to see a change in culture, then we need to show culture we're committed to the word of our king. Are you committed to it? You can't be committed to something you don't know. You biblically illiterate when it comes to the laws of God, the case law of God, do you even know them? You can't be committed to something you don't know. Well, they gave themselves to the obedience of Christ, Christ alone, to worship their God. So compromised living, worshiping any and everything, is not going to have an influence on culture. Only faithful commitment to the one we claim to serve will cause God, he'll cause people to stand up and take notice. And here's the thing. If we regress from culture as salt, we leave them to decay and putrefy. When we refuse to be salt to our culture, it just demonstrates we hate our culture. Right? We don't really believe our God either. We don't believe that our God can impact our culture by us being salt. You see, we lack faith. We lack the faith of these men because we think, what's the use? It's only a few of us. How many men changed that day? How many men changed the course of that day? It just took three men, right? You don't need numbers. You just need to be committed. You just need to be faithful. The point of Hebrews 11 and the point of this particular story is that you can have an impact. And that impact comes when you start giving yourself to the causes of the Lord, serving Him and worshiping Him, making your mind up that compromise is not an option. And these three men showed up at the biggest event in Babylon, purposing not to compromise. They showed up at the biggest festival. Think about the biggest festivals that go around in our country. What if just three men showed up and were faithful? What would happen? Well, if we desire to have an impact on tyranny of this current national government, then we need to commit ourselves to the God who can change the heart and the word of our civil leaders. But we as a church, we've been negligent in this area. As a church, we have abandoned God's law. We've been watching the divinity of the state grow. And our current government does not think they have to give an account to anyone, do they? And we live in a perverse, in very perverse days when our government calls good evil and evil good. As Parker read this morning out of Isaiah, they call light darkness and darkness light. So we need a king. We need the king to change the word and the law of these representative kings. In order for that to happen, we need to show them what true obedience to live into the true king looks like. Nebuchadnezzar ends by issuing a decree, a new law. And this law is basically an anti-blasphemy law. This king has decreed, you cannot blaspheme the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You know, there's a lot of people who are saying, you know, well, we don't want blasphemy laws here. You already have them. It's called hate speech. There are a lot of people who say they don't want reconstruction in this land. But you already have reconstruction. The secularists, the humanists are reconstructing your culture in every area. And they have their anti-blasphemy laws. You can't say things against certain perverse groups. We want God to change the heart of the king such that we have anti-blasphemy laws where our God's name cannot be dishonored. He gives them legal protection. He gives legal protection to the name of God with severe sanctions, as you read verse 29. Running out of time. What have we learned here? Let me just hit a couple of applications here. First thing we've learned is, number one, God is sovereign over the word of the king. This means that the king is under a higher law. Therefore, he has no right, he has no authority to command that which is contrary to God's law. Today, the West is controlled by a theory called legal positivism. Legal positivism. Write it down and go look it up. I don't have time to go into all of this. It's a rejection of a higher law. It is even a rejection of a weakened doctrine of natural law that the Catholics believe in. But legal positivism boldly asserts that law is whatever the king or the elected officials say that it is. In other words, whoever is in control makes law without any regard or concern to being held accountable by a higher law or a higher authority. All right. And so why is this working? Well, it's working because the church stopped a long time warning the government, putting a spotlight on corruption, putting a spotlight on the abuse of their power, putting a spotlight on ungodly laws and that they're going to give an account. But the guiding legal theory of the day is this legal positivism. And so almost all of our representatives, even if they claim to be Christian, have been indoctrinated. They operate under this philosophy because they've all been indoctrinated under this nonsense for the last 60 years. No one in the public school, no one in the university systems, even in many of the Christian universities, are being taught that there's a higher law. They're being taught that law is whatever the state says it is. And that's why you live in the conditions you live in today. And so you better obey what the state says. This is why sodomy laws are struck down by the Supreme Court. Why are sodomy laws struck down in the Supreme Court? Well, they're under the impression that the law is whatever they say it is, and that they don't have to give an account because there is no higher law that they have to submit to. And we are the problem. The church is the problem. Because we keep electing men and women into office who do not intend to honor God. They don't recognize Him. And so many within the church don't care. Do you? Does it bother you? Does it bother you that our representatives don't desire to honor God? Does it bother you that they are just a reflection of the people who put them there? They don't care because we don't care. Well, it may not bother us, but it is an offense to God, and there's a day of reckoning coming. I don't know when it's going to come. But He will shake the foundations. He's going to shake the foundations in such a way that all those things not built upon the rock word of Lord Jesus Christ will collapse. It won't just be in the civil realm. Either. All churches not built upon the rock word of Christ will collapse. All families that are not built upon the rock word of Jesus Christ will collapse. Anything built upon a foundation of sand will collapse. Number two, we as the people of God are called to change the word of wicked kings. Now, how do we do that? Well, you've been given an example this morning. You obey the word of the King, the King of Kings. We live under the sovereignty of God and recognize that He is the King over all. The people of God in every age must resist the bounds of an overreaching government. We must not submit to a government that calls us to sin against our God. There are certain non-negotiable principles you must have in your life, and this is one of them. Defying God is not an option for the child of God. Worshipping a false God, acknowledging false gods, is not an option for the child of God, the true God. There are various means in which we resist, though. We need to publish in writing. We need to preach that Jesus Christ rules the nations. This is just part of the gospel. If this is not part of the gospel, then what we've done is we've just saved people to be under a humanistic hell on earth. Christ came to bring His dominion and redeem every institution. We preach the higher law of God over men. The reason why our land is in the condition that it's in today is because the church no longer preaches these principles. We need to understand that Christ did not call us to make disciples of the nations so that we could be comfortable either. What that commission that He gave us purposely puts us into a fight. For those Christians who have chosen comfort over obedience, they're going to find themselves facing a dilemma of the fiery furnace and what to do next. If your worldview is that Christ saved you to be comfortable, when you're presented with the fiery furnace, you're not going to know how to respond biblically. The moment you realize that Christ has put you in a fight to advance His kingdom, then the furnace is what you should expect, not comfort. And we have so many ways to resist. We have so many ways as Christians to resist. We need to publish. We need to preach. We still have the ability to participate in the political process. We can run for office ourselves. We can pray. We've lost in our worship the imprecatory psalms because we've been conditioned to think, well, they're not nice. But those psalms, most of those psalms would offend many in the church. But those psalms have been preserved for us to pray over wicked rulers. But we won't pray them. Rush Dooney said this, "It is a perversion of Paul's intent," talking about 1 Timothy 2:1, where he asks us to pray for all men. Rush Dooney says, "It is a perversion of Paul's intent to pray simply, Lord, bless the president, bless the Congress, bless our governor, and so on. It is usually true they need not blessing, but conversion and even judgment." And so when we pray for them, we should pray for their conversion. But if they're not converted, we should pray that God would remove them and put godly rulers in their place. But many in the church don't want godly rulers. Well, what we've seen in our text this morning is another way to resist. And this is what we call civil disobedience. Civil disobedience is a very serious thing, though. We don't just jump to civil disobedience. It's the last option when there are no other options. And this is exactly where these three men were at, right? This is the option we must choose whenever we cannot obey God and man at the same time. Civil disobedience is what you do when you cannot obey God and man at the same time. Another way that resistance takes place is by arms. And this has happened in the history of the church. Once again, before you pick up arms against your government, it should be taken very seriously. This is one of those last results when no other option is available. And one of the things that came out of the Reformation is no single individual has the right to take up arms against their government, to take offensive measures to overthrow it. In other words, I don't have the right to take my arms up to the governor's mansion or up to the White House and overthrow the president. I just don't have that right. All right? However, when tyranny presents itself, and when I talk about tyranny, I'm not talking about too many traffic lights, but I'm talking about real rights are trampled and the state has placed itself in a divine state, then protest through a lower magistrate is legitimate. We see this done throughout history. We've even seen it in our history, right? Those who are in lower office can lead and protest those in higher office. For example, you're seeing this in Florida where Governor DeSantis has been pushing back on some of the overreaching tactics of the federal government. One of the things they tried went to the court and the court shot it down. But he is showing you an example of resistance. Okay, so he's pushing back. Think about this. This happened in our Revolutionary War, right? When you think about the Revolutionary War, an armed mob did not rise up against the tyranny of England. The magistrates in this land led them in godly order against the tyranny of England. Our revolution looked nothing like the mob rule of the French Revolution. I think, you know, we have so many levers that we can pull before this one is actually pulled. But nevertheless, it is a godly way to deal with tyranny. One of the greatest ways we have to influence this land is by walking in obedience to change the king's law. If these men would have bowed down before the law of man, this law would have never been changed in Daniel 3, right? It was changed because they had the courage to obey God in the face of tyranny. And so God can use us to change the king's law when it needs to be changed and when it comes in conflict with God's law. So remember these principles. So how do we resist? We need to write, publish. We need to preach. We need to call out for those to submit to the true King of Kings, right? We need to walk in obedience to the king to the King's of Kings commands, right? If we need to do civil disobedience. Civil disobedience is only required when God's law and man's law come to conflict with one another. So it's kind of a measure of last resort. And the real last resort is that taking up of arms. But that taking up of arms only happens when the lower magistrate resists a tyrannical higher magistrate. Does that make sense? I'll make sure, you know, there's a lot we probably need to flesh out and talk about. But I want you to at least be aware of these biblical reform principles of civil disobedience and resistance, because this is getting a lot of traction right now. So is that, for example, what happened back in January when these men stormed the Capitol? We don't support that. There's no lower magistrate working through that at all. There's no representative, true sovereign government that supported that at all. So this, these wild mobs with guns is not what we're saying. We're not supporting that at all. All right. I hope that makes sense to you, but if not, we can sit down and flesh these principles out a little bit more, but I want you to at least be aware of them. Finally, we live in a very similar culture to what Babylon was like. They were very polytheistic. The same is true within our land. There are many gods represented in our land today, but the great lie of our day is that they all represent the same God, right? Well, I mean, we have this idea that the God of the Muslim, the Hindu gods, the Buddhists, and all these other things, well, it's just all different ways to the one same God. That's the lie of our day. No, there's only one true God, the triune God of the Scriptures. And when we break His law, what we're saying, or let me say it this way, we break the laws of God when we say that Jesus is not the only way to God the Father. Now, I want you to understand, one of the new blasphemy laws that are being passed around, you know, they're not official yet, but they're being imposed on you, is that when you're exclusively saying that there's only one name in heaven and earth by which man can be saved, that's blasphemy. It's blasphemy to this secular culture because all these other gods are just as good as Jesus. He's just one of many ways to God. So we have to resolve to stand our ground here on this point, that there's only one God and we must give an account to Him. We need this reminder of Daniel 3. We need the reminder of Hebrews 11, that through faith they subdued kingdoms, they worked righteousness, they clothed the mouths of lions, and they even quenched the fiery flames. Father, give us this faith that we read about. Strengthen our faith and encourage it. We thank You for these godly examples that have been given to us. Lord, help us to firm up our positions. Help us to understand the principles that we are to live by that are non-negotiables. Help us to walk in a way that pleases You. And Father, we live in wicked days where evil is being called good, good is being called evil. And so we need You to change the hearts of those who rule over us. But Father, we also know You need to work within our own church. Continue to purge out any of these foreign thoughts, these philosophies that are not in agreement with Your word. Father, the baggage that we bring in here, Lord, may You purge them, prune them out of our lives so that we may think thoughts after Christ. Continue to transform our minds through the preaching of Your word and help us to think in a way that brings You honor and glory. And so, Father, I pray that You'd strengthen our faith. I pray that You'd give us a sense of urgency. Oh, the fiery furnace is just a picture of what waits those who are dropped into hell for all eternity. Father, may we not be cold or callous, but may we have a sense and a desire to tell those of the loving grace of Christ Jesus, who has saved sinners from their sins, who has purchased us, who saves us from the penalty and the curse of the law. Father, may we tell sinners of the good and gracious nature of a God, the Father, who sent His Son, so that they don't have to taste Your wrath, but they may know the peacefulness, the joy that comes from serving Christ as their King and as their groom. And so, Father, we just ask that You give us a sense of urgency to take this gospel to those who are perishing. May we truly be salt again, and may this land be recovered to Your glory and for the honor of Your name. And we ask all this in Christ's name.